Good afternoon. Shabbat Shalom. Often, you'll hear me talk about being in Kissimmee. Today, I'm in Orlando, nearby, near Kissimmee, but in Orlando, actually. From Osceola County, we've gone to Orange County. Now, maybe some of you are listening in Orange County, California. Well, wherever you're listening from, we bid you greetings from here in Florida, and we're grateful that this can be heard just wherever, anywhere in the world. On Sunday night, December 21st, as you know, the day darkens, we'll be in the 25th day of the ninth month on the sacred calendar, which is the beginning of a winter festival kept in the Jewish community, which is important from the point of view of church history. It is not commanded on the whole church to keep, but the historical events of that season are critically important in terms of the history of the church. And so it is a Jewish holiday, as you know, the Feast of Dedication or Hanukkah. I was noticing that even in this area, you know, there's not a large Jewish population, but I'm noticing as we get closer to Hanukkah, there seems to be a lot of excitement and anticipation of some kind of holiday coming up. And I was wondering about it, and then I began to realize that now that Barack Obama is becoming president, there's probably going to be a lot of more activity around Kwanzaa than there used to be, which comes on December 26th. I'm kidding, but let's go to John 10. Speaking of Hanukkah, I was debating what kind of title to give to this talk, and I was afraid that I might have used this term before, so maybe I'll just go ahead and use it again anyway, just as an update. I will call this talk this season in salvation history, but then I'll say 5769 to give it a date, you know, so you'll know if it was given at an earlier time. This was given in the Hebrew year 5769. So this season in salvation history, 5769. In other words, the significance of this season for the church is what I'm dealing with. And of course, I've dealt with the issue before, but I want to deal with this particular season, which is almost winter, at this particular time, and the significance for the church. And I want to begin by going to John 10, because, you know, John is focusing a lot of his material around the holy day cycle, the festival cycle. And he also includes a festival that is not commanded on the entire church, but was kept by the early Christians because they were Jewish, and so they would have kept this festival. And it does tie in with a lot of important spiritual lessons, so he actually records it. And it's found in John 10:22. And the irony of that is that the Hebrew Bible concludes with the end of the Persian period. And then we have the new kingdom, the Greco-Macedonian kingdom, after the Persian period. You know, when I was in high school, I used to ask people, what's purple and conquered the world? And, of course, the exact answer was Alexander the Grape. And I would get a laugh, and I would get a groan now from you people out there, but I used to get laughs when I was a teenager. But when Alexander the Great took over, that was a new period in history, and the Jews recognized it as a new period. And they had a background to understand this. There were prophecies that guided them in this. So the canon closed. With the coming of Alexander the Great, the Hebrew canon closed. And so the events of Hanukkah, therefore, are not part of the canon. In prophecy, they are. There's prophecies that are clearly telling you about Hanukkah, but the name itself, the Festival of Dedication, is not there. But we do have it in intertestamental writings. We do have Hebrew writings, although they were not preserved in Hebrew as far as I know. I believe they were preserved in Greek. But we have writings of the Jews, intertestamental writings, that talk about the holiday of Hanukkah. And the Catholics have included them in their Bible. And so if you have a Catholic Bible, or maybe even an Anglican Bible in England, I think the Anglican Church uses this material also. It's 1st and 2nd Maccabees. There's also a 3rd and 4th, but what's more important is the 1st and 2nd Maccabees. And I think historians give the most credence to 1st Maccabees. And in those books, you have the history of the period of Hanukkah, but they're not part of the Hebrew Bible. So ironically, where you had the festival mentioned by name is in the New Testament. in John 10. So in John 10, as I said, John was talking about the holy day seasons. And so in John 7, you're at the Feast of Tabernacles. In John 8, you're on the eighth day. And probably John 9 and even in through 10, you may still be on that eighth day. And then finally, it switches to the next season, which is the winter season or late fall, which is Hanukkah. Now this year, Hanukkah will come as winter begins. I believe winter begins on the 22nd, and that's the first day. So Hanukkah will occur normally late fall, early winter. Since it's an eight-day festival, some of it will normally overlap into the winter, even if it comes relatively early on the Roman calendar. I think some of it will normally overlap into the winter. So I'm in John 10 and verse 22. Now it was the Feast of Dedication in Jerusalem, and it was winter. And Jesus walked in the temple in Solomon's porch. So he's right at the center of the action. And so he's obviously observing the holiday. I mean, if you're going to go to the Washington Monument on the 4th of July, you're probably there to celebrate the holiday of the 4th of July. You could be somewhere else if you wanted to avoid it. He's right there, right where they're celebrating Hanukkah, because Hanukkah is the Feast of Dedication. Dedication of what? The temple. So there he is at the temple with the celebrants, and they're celebrating the rededication of the temple roughly two centuries before this time. It's more or less around the bicentennial of that time. I remember the bicentennial of this country in 1976. That was quite an exciting time for various reasons. Anyway, we're at the Feast of Dedication, and Jesus is there, and he talks to them, to the crowd that's there at that time. In fact, it's interesting what they asked him to do. This was a very exciting time. It's a time when they talk about their liberation from oppression, a time of victory when God intervened for them, a time when they defended their law, their way of life against of forces who are seeking to destroy it. And so obviously there's going to be an increase of zeal and nationalism, if you want to call it that, and fervor. And so they challenged him in verse 24. Then the Jews surrounded him and said to him, "How long do you keep us in doubt? If you are the Christ, tell us plainly." Well, at some point I may get into that. I have in past years. But I wanted to give background today. As I said, the talk I'm giving today is this season in salvation history, 5769. I want to give a background to the festival of Hanukkah. And as I said, the Jews had prophecies that directed them to that festival and possibly even directed their observance of the festival. In other words, it might have been a self-fulfilling prophecy. Having read it, they may have decided to read it and do it. Or what may have happened is that they read it and then in retrospect thought, wow, now we understand. It's just as it was written there. That's possibly what happened. A lot of times when you read a prophecy that's been fulfilled, you think, oh, it's so obvious. It's not always that obvious until it happens. Then you look back, oh, yeah, but it's not always that obvious. I mean, Christ taught his disciples all that time, and they didn't really get the picture until after he was crucified, resurrected. Then it all came together, what he had told them, and the prophecies just, came out, and they understood. But they didn't understand until they'd actually gone through and then looked back in retrospect. And it may have been the same for the Jews at the time of the Maccabees, and looking back, they may have understood. But as I said, it's possible they read these prophecies, and it actually directed their, what they did. Like, as I said, it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. But what I wanted to talk about today was how it begins, the background of all of this. As I said, we come to the end of the Old Testament period when the holy books are put together, and we come to the end of an empire, the Persian Empire, and the beginning of a new empire. And towards the end of the Old Testament period, the Jews are being reorganized by Ezra and Nehemiah, and we have the prophet Malachi. He's the last of the prophets until Yohanan. Who's Yohanan? John the Baptist. But until John the Baptist, we had roughly four centuries, and we don't have canonical material. We do have, however, a little bit of an update to the book of Nehemiah, which carries it to the end of the Persian period. And if you go to Nehemiah 12, evidently there's an update here which covers the high priests up until the end of the Persian period. So I'm trying to turn it to Nehemiah. I'm desperately flipping my Bible. All right, here it goes, Job. All right, Nehemiah, I want to go to the 12th chapter of Nehemiah. All right, if you have a New King James, please go to page 712. All right, anyway, so here in Nehemiah, 12 and verse 22. During the reign of Darius the Persian, and there were several kings with that name, and it was a Darius, an earlier Darius that had authorized the temple to be built, and then a later Darius that Alexander conquered, Alexander the Great. During the reign of Darius the Persian, a record was also kept of the Levites and priests who had been heads of their fathers' houses in the days of Eliashib, Joiada, Johanan, and Jaddua. Now, this may be the very Jaddua that Josephus writes about, because it may be that this is an update, updating the kings until the end of the Persian period. And after that, as I said, you don't have canonical material in the Old Testament. But you did have a high priest, Jaddua, and Josephus writes about him, and it's a very interesting story, and I have not read the story in a long time. There's another version of the story that's in the Talmud itself. Now, there's a tractate in the Talmud. The Talmud has volumes that are called tractates, 63 of them, and there's one called Yoma, which has to do with the Day of Atonement. And on folio 69, side A, There's a section similar to this, but frankly, I think the Josephus' account is more historically accurate. With all due respect to the Talmudists, I think that what they wrote there was somewhat maybe allegorical or symbolic. I think that a more literal history is found in Josephus. Josephus was writing at the end of the first century, around the time that John was writing the book of Revelation. And so Josephus's material is kind of paralleling the New Testament period. He wrote at the end of the first century. And he had been in Jerusalem. He had been in Israel. He was a priest. He had been in the land of Israel at the time of the wars against the Romans. He had defected to the Romans. He knew, you know, which side was going to win. And so the Romans then, you know, later on he was patronized, sponsored by the Romans, and he wrote a history of the Jews. He was very pro-Jewish, but at the same time, you know, he did not favor the war against Rome. He knew it was a losing cause, and he actually wound up defecting, as I said. But he was very sympathetic to the Jews and wrote this pro-Jewish history. So here we are at the end of the first century reading this account. And it's very interesting, and I want to get into it. It's talking here about Alexander the Great. Now, I know this is very interesting to my family, but he was only 20 years old when he took over Macedonia. And all right. That line, believe it or not, is an old Kurt Russell movie from the Disney days, from the old Disney movies. But anyway, let's go to Josephus. Now, if you own a Josephus, and actually a lot of you do, if you're Bible students, a lot of you own a Josephus, and the standard Josephus is probably still the Whiston translation, W-H-I-S-T-O-N. It's probably still what most people own. And it's this is in Book 11, and it's in Chapter 8 of Book 11, and it's Paragraph 3. And a lot of you have the edition I have, so it's on page 243. So Alexander the Great is now in the Middle East and rolling right along. So Alexander came into Syria. I'm reading now from the historical account. So Alexander came into Syria and took Damascus. And when he had obtained Sidon, he besieged Tyre. So now he's in Lebanon, okay? Alexander the Great is in Lebanon. When he sent an epistle to the Jewish high priest to send him some auxiliaries and to supply his army with provisions, and that what presents he formerly sent to Darius, he would now send to him and choose the friendship of the Macedonians. So he told the high priest, I want help from you, I want support, and I want tribute. It's time for you to change sides. You know, go from being pro-Persian to pro-Macedonian. And that he should never repent of so doing. All right. And the high priest answered the messengers that he had given his oath to Darius not to bear arms against him. And he said that he would not transgress this while Darius was in the land of the living. Now, that may have been a very spiritual decision because, you know, the Bible talks about how Zedekiah had made a promise like that to Nebuchadnezzar, had violated it, and Nebuchadnezzar came and you know, wiped the floor with those people. You know, so he may have decided, no, I made a commitment, and somehow I'm going to keep the commitment, and God will intervene. But it was a very risky thing to do, to tell Alexander, sorry, no dice, as we say, no soap, or, you know, I'm not going to do this. That was quite a risky thing to do. Upon hearing this answer, Alexander was very angry. You know, he wasn't the kind of guy you wanted to cross. And though he determined not to leave Tyre, which he was just ready to be taken, yet as soon as he had taken it, he threatened that he would make an expedition against the Jewish high priest, and through him teach all men to whom they must keep their oaths. In other words, you better do what I tell you. Forget whatever, you know, whoever else was around. Do what I tell you. Excuse me. When he had with a good deal of pains during the siege taken Tyre and had settled its affairs, he came to the city of Gaza. Well, you know, Gaza's still in the news all the time. That's the southwestern part of the land of Israel. So it's the coastal part, so he entered that way. And besieged both the city and him that was governor of the garrison, whose name was Baba Meses. Now, let's jump to where he begins to get involved in Jerusalem. Okay, Alexander, when he had taken Gaza, now I'm not reading word for word, I'm jumping now to, if you're trying to follow along with me in your Josephus, I'm in around the middle of the fourth paragraph of that section. Around the middle of I'm on page 244 now, and I'm in the middle of the fourth paragraph of Josephus, all right? Everybody follow so far? Alexander's in Lebanon. The Jewish high priest wouldn't pay him off. speaking of payoffs, that's in the news a lot lately. Anyway, the high priest wouldn't pay him off, so he invades Gaza, and now he's heading for, the heartland of the promised land. Now Alexander, when he had taken Gaza, made haste to go up to Jerusalem. And Jaddua, the high priest, when he heard that, was in an agony, you could just imagine, and under terror, as not knowing how he should meet the Macedonians, since the king was displeased of his foregoing disobedience. All right, so here we are in a mess. If we're Jews, we're in a mess, you know. And in those days, they didn't speak Yiddish, but if they were speaking Yiddish, they would have said, oy vey, right? Anyway, he therefore ordained that the people should make supplications and should join with him in offering sacrifices to God, whom he sought to protect that nation and to deliver them from the perils that were coming upon them, whereupon God warned him in a dream. So it's interesting. That's what Josephus records. Now, he came from the priestly community, so he evidently had this information or this tradition. God warned him in a dream, which came upon him after he had offered sacrifice, that he should take courage and adorn the city and open the gates, that the rest should appear in white garments, but that he and the priest should meet the king in the habits proper to their order. Dress in your best priestly garb when you greet Alexander, without the dread of any ill consequences, which the providence of God would prevent. So that's what the vision told him, the dream told him. Dress in white garments, the priests come out in your holy garments, and just open the city, decorate the city, and just greet him. Give him a warm greeting, peaceful greeting. Upon which, when he rose from his sleep, he greatly rejoiced, and declared to all the warning he had received from God, according to which dream he acted entirely, and so waited for the coming of the king. So now here we are. The Jews are preparing on faith to just march out and warmly greet Alexander, hoping that he's not going to come and just devastate the place. Now, he had advisors who didn't like Jews. You ever notice that some Gentiles don't like Jews that well? He had advisors who were down on Jews, but he was his own man, Alexander. He was going to make his own decisions. So anyway, we go on now to paragraph 5 there in Josephus. And when he understood that he was not far from the city, he went out in procession with the priests and the multitude of citizens. The procession was venerable, and the manner of it different from that of other nations. So they were greeting him in a very special way, very warmly, and in their best attire. It reached to a place called Safa, which name translated into Greek signifies a prospect. This is probably Har HaTzofim, the Mount Scopus, where you get a view of Jerusalem. And today there's a campus of Hebrew University there. So he went to Mount Scopus, what we call. For you have a prospect both of Jerusalem and of the temple. You have a good view of the city from that mountain. And so that's where they went. Or that's how far the procession reached. And when the Phoenicians and the Chaldeans that followed him thought they should have liberty to plunder the city and torment the high priest to death, which the king's displeasure fairly promised them, the very reverse of it happened. So there were some people with Alexander the Great who were just ready to pounce on the Jews. You know, because they were people who lived nearby and had a hostility to them. But that's not what Alexander had in mind. He was keeping control of the situation. For Alexander, when he saw the multitude at a distance in white garments, while the priest stood clothed with fine linen and the high priest in purple and scarlet clothing with a mitre on his head, having the golden plate where on the name of God was engraved, so he had his breastplate on and so on, the priest, it must look very impressive. He approached by himself and adored that name and first saluted the high priest. So Alexander, seeing the high priest, got off his horse and worshiped the high priest. Could you imagine? What a wonderful surprise. The Jews also did all together with one voice salute Alexander and encompass him about. So they treated him with great respect. And there is a tradition, I'll jump a little bit ahead of myself. Alexander was very favorably inclined to the Jews. And so the Jews had a good relationship with Alexander the Great. Now there's a tradition that I have been taught ever since I was a child, that the Jews were monotheistic, they worshipped only one God, and somehow Alexander the Great respected that. And so he didn't expect the Jews to sort of add him to their pantheon, Jupiter and Athena and, I'm mixing languages, and various gods and goddesses, and let's add Alexander. No, he knew they wouldn't do that. But what they promised to do was name all of their male children Alexander the next year. And that's a Jewish tradition that Jewish boys were named Alexander. So that Alexander then became a Jewish name, even though it's Greek, became a Jewish name. But, I try to track down where that's found written, and I haven't found it. I haven't found it written anywhere. And yet I was taught it as a child. So, I went to the computer, and I kept seeing the story, and I never saw a footnote. Where is it? I looked at the Talmud. I didn't see it. I looked at Josephus. I didn't see it. So somebody at some point must have come up with this idea. So someday I would like to track down where it's written, because it reminds me of a story. I hadn't planned to tell the story, but I think I will, because I find it very entertaining. I'll try not to mention a lot of names so that nobody's embarrassed. I was a consultant back in the old days when I was a faculty member of Ambassador College. I was one whom they consulted when they wanted to answer letters on certain historical points. And so one time I was called by a friend of mine who was in the letter answering department, and so I repeated something I had learned from Dr. Hay, who was really the authority, back then. But they didn't always bother him all the time. Sometimes they went to me, especially if it was something Jewish. They would go to me, since Dr. Hay was German, and so they would come to me, and so this fellow came to me, and I told him about some technical points that Dr. Hay had taught me. Okay, then some months later, I saw it published in a magazine. According to Jewish tradition, this and this and this happened. And I told Linda, I said, Jewish tradition? I was the one that told him that. I got it from Dr. Hay, and I told him. Now it's a Jewish tradition. Now what happens if somebody finds that article 200 years from now? On the Wikipedia, it's going to become a Jewish tradition. for one thing, the whole thing's wrong. We had to revise it later anyway. It wasn't even true. But anyway, there is a tradition that in order to honor Alexander, all the Jewish boys were named Alexander that year, and someday I'll find out who wrote it. Anyway, let's go back to Alexander. So he came into the high priest, and he was impressed with the high priest. So let me see. So he adored the high priest. He approached by himself and adored that name. The name of Yahweh, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, YHWH, and first saluted the high priest. The Jews also did all together with one voice salute Alexander and encompass him about, whereupon the kings of Syria and the rest were surprised at what Alexander had done and supposed him disordered in his mind. Well, was he going crazy? However, Parmenio alone went up to him and asked him how it came to pass that when all others adored him, he should adore the high priest of the Jews. To whom he replied, I did not adore him, but that God who hath honored him with his high priesthood. For I saw this very person in a dream, in this very habit, when I was at Dios in Macedonia, who, when I was considering with myself how I might obtain the dominion of Asia, exhorted me to make no delay, but boldly to pass over the sea thither. For that he would conduct my army and would give me the dominion over the Persians. So God had given Alexander a vision, evidently, where he saw this high priest in his dream. And the high priest said, go, you're going to win. Of course, this is what Alexander said, that he had seen this high priest in a vision, encouraging him that he would be victorious. Anyway, whence it is that having seen no other in that habit, and now seeing this person in it, and remembering that vision and the exhortation which I had in my dream, I believe that I bring this army under the divine conduct and shall therewith conquer Darius and destroy the power of the Persians. You know, so it gave him confidence that he was doing the right thing and that all things will succeed according to what is in my own mind. And when they had said this to Parmenio and had given the high priest his right hand, the priests ran along by him and he came into the city. Must have been a very exciting time. You can just imagine what a dramatic period. And when he went up into the temple, he offered sacrifice to God. Alexander the Great did that, according to the high priest's direction, and magnificently treated both the high priest and the priests. Now, here's an interesting part of this story. And when the book of Daniel was showed him, whereon Daniel declared that one of the Greeks should destroy the empire of the Persians, he supposed that himself was the person intended. So he saw prophecies about himself in Daniel. Isn't that interesting? What an exciting thing to read a prophecy. That's talking about me, he felt. And he was right, you know. Now, what was shown, it doesn't say here. Josephus doesn't say, but that's what I'm going to get into in the 30 seconds I'm going to have left. I'm going to get into these prophecies. And as he was then glad, he dismissed the multitude for the present. And the next day he called them to him and bade them ask what favors they pleased of him. Whereupon the high... Now, I mean, you can imagine how excited he was. Here he goes to the holy books of the Jews, and the books prophesy about him. So you can imagine he was pretty flattered. And so he said, well, okay, what do you want, you know? Whereupon the high priest desired that they might enjoy the laws of their forefathers and might pay no tribute in the seventh year. So see, he said... In the seventh year, we let our land rest. So please exempt us from tribute the seventh year. He granted all they desired, and when they entreated him that he would permit the Jews in Babylon and Media to enjoy their own laws also, he willingly promised to do hereafter what they desired. So he allowed the Jews in the diaspora, in what is today Iraq and Iran, to continue to live by their own laws. You know, they would be able to keep the Sabbath, etc. He willingly promised to do hereafter what they desired, and when he said to the multitude that if any of them would enlist themselves in his army on this condition that they should continue under the laws of their forefathers and live according to them, he was willing to take them with him. So he said, you know, you can keep kosher in my army. I won't make you eat treif, you know, unclean food or whatever, and I won't make you violate your law. So why don't you join up? And many were ready to accompany him in his wars. So actually a lot of Israelis joined the Alexander the Great's army. Now you know why he was so successful against Iran. He had these Israeli soldiers with him. All right, anyway. So that's an interesting account there and of what happened. And I'm going to just read a little bit more about that. Actually, I'm not going to read much more. But in paragraph 6, so when Alexander had thus settled matters at Jerusalem, he led the army into the neighboring cities. And that's really is as far as I want to go. So this gives you perhaps some of the background. Now, I can't guarantee that Josephus is a credible historian, but it's interesting what he did write. And I want to go now into the prophecies that perhaps Alexander the Great was shown. I want to go to the book of Daniel. I want to turn first to Daniel 11. Now, in Daniel 11, there's just a couple of verses. I'm going to jump in here. No, I guess I'll start in the beginning. Also, in the first year of Darius the Mede, this is not Darius the king of Persia. This is a man who was called in the Bible Darius the Mede. He had another name in secular history. Also, in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him. This is an angel talking. He's getting a vision here. I'm breaking into the middle of a thought. This is Daniel being given a prophecy. So the I, even I, this is this angel speaking to him. And now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings will arise in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than them all. By his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece. Now this fourth ruler was Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus, or Ahasuerosh, who's known in history as Xerxes, X-E-R-X-E-S. I guess the Greeks would call him Xerxes. And anyway, so he's Ahasuerosh, or Ahasuerus. He was this very rich king, and he did try to invade Greece. I think we all know that story, that he was unsuccessful, but he did attempt to conquer Greece. Then a mighty king shall arise who shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And this is Alexander the Great. Now, Alexander the Great died and his kingdom was divided into four parts. I'm not sure that he understood this, but it is interesting that when he died, you know, he didn't really leave a successor. So this was almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy in a way. As I recall the history, he was dying and they said, who's going to inherit your kingdom? And he said, my kingdom will go to the strongest. So he pretty much left things, you know, to be settled by his various generals. So his kingdom was divided into four parts, as you know if you've studied ancient history. We have in the west was Cassander, and then around what is Turkey today was Lysimachus, and then in what is Syria today was Seleucus, and in Egypt was Ptolemy. And what's important for the Jews was the fact that there was a king in Syria, the Seleucid Empire in Syria, the Ptolemaic Empire in Egypt that were battling back and forth with the land of Israel as the buffer between them. King of the north, king of the south, you know, so that's what, and that's where what happens in Daniel 11. Anyway, verse 4, and when he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken up and divided toward the four winds of heaven, but not among his posterity. See, it wasn't his sons that inherited it, it was four generals. Not according to his dominion with which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be uprooted even for others besides these. You know, so, it, you know, it continues on and breaks up even into smaller parts over time. The four parts don't remain intact either. All right, that's one prophecy of Alexander the Great. And we're going to go to another one now, if you don't mind, and that's in Daniel 7. This is the very famous prophecy of the four beasts that symbolize four great empires that rule the world, that interact with God's church. They rule over the land of Israel. And, of course, we have the Babylonian, the Neo-Babylonian Empire, the Chaldean Empire, and we have the Medo-Persian Empire. And then we have the Greco-Macedonian, which is Alexander the Great. It begins with him. And so the bear is the Medo-Persian Empire, and they operated like a bear. They lumbered, you know, they went slowly and devoured, and they were very big and massive. They used massive force. Their forte was numbers. They just overwhelmed you, crushed you like a bear would. You know, the traditional bear hug, whereas Alexander the Great was a swift-moving army, and its strength with its maneuverability. You know, in military, I have studied military history, and I've also studied physics, and there's a relationship. Force equals mass times acceleration, F equals MA. And so you want to get there, as the famous general of the South, the Confederacy, said, I think his name was Nathan Bedford Forrest, he said, I get there firstest with the mostest. So you got to get there early with force. So it's mass times acceleration. So Alexander the Great had mastered that. His army was fast and maneuverable. The Persians had huge numbers, but Alexander had maneuverability. And so he's pictured as a leopard who moves quickly and swiftly. And of course, his conquest was amazingly swift. You know, he took over Macedonia in 356, and by in 336, and by 323. He ruled all the way to India. When he died, he had a huge empire. Verse 6. After this, I looked, and here was another like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird. See, it went quickly, this leopard. Not only did it go quickly like a leopard, but even like a bird. But the four wings have another meaning, as you know, the fact that it broke up into four parts later. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. Ah, see, it broke up into four heads finally. So it was a four-headed leopard. It had four wings, I guess, to show how it went in every direction and very quickly. But at the same time, had four heads because it broke into four parts. Now, I think what was shown Alexander was the eighth chapter of Daniel, where he is very prominent. And I want to go to Daniel 8. Daniel 8. Now, Daniel 8 is an interesting chapter because it's a prophecy of what happened at the time of Antiochus, about a century and a half before Christ. It's a clear prophecy of that, any commentary can tell you. Now, obviously, there's an end-time significance because what happened at the time of Antiochus, a century and a half before Christ, is a foreshadowing of what is to come right before Christ's return. He himself said that. Jesus himself said, look for events to occur very much like they occurred around the time of Hanukkah. Those kind of events are going to come right before I return. That was the sign he gave. So it's important from a prophetic point of view. But, you know, the specific details were fulfilled at the time of Antiochus. Nevertheless, Daniel 8 became a really major force in the United States. In the 19th century, in the 1840s, there was a huge movement called the Adventist movement, and many people became a part of it. And it was led by William Miller. And William Miller encouraged people to believe that Christ was coming again, but he went beyond that. He used Daniel 8 to compute when Christ would return. So he said he was coming in 1843, and then that didn't happen. So he reconfigured, and he said, 1844, you know, I forget when, maybe Day of Atonement or whatever he said it was going to be, October or whatever, 1844, he gave a specific date. And it really did cause a lot of hysteria. There's a book that you might want to read that talks about this, which is called The Burned Over District, The Burned Over District by Whitney Cross, a classic history book written, I think, in the early 50s. And it talks about many things, many movements of that period, but one section is about the Adventist movement. And it really did have a big impact on American religion. In fact, I suppose to this very day, it's why many, many churches in America emphasize eschatology and the second coming of Christ. In effect, it put that back on the front burner. It put that concept of the second coming of Christ back in people's consciousness. I think it had been, you know, buried over time in mainstream Christianity. So it put that idea back as something to consider. And so from that time on, we've had an interest in American religion, in Bible prophecy and the second coming of Christ. Well, anyway, William Miller was wrong on that point. Obviously, Christ didn't return in 1844. So that became known as the Great Disappointment. But one thing it did was it encouraged a group of his followers to keep the Sabbath. They believed that the reason that they did not quite understand prophecy correctly is because they hadn't been keeping the Sabbath. So they became Seventh-day Adventists. And that church is still with us, and it's a very major church. I guess it's considered sectarian in a way. It's not mainstream because it is considered, quote-unquote, legalistic. But when I say it's a major church, it has a large number of adherents, and it is a force out there, the Seventh-day Adventists, particularly in some areas such as Southern California. So I've said they about seven times, so let me just say that the Seventh-day Adventist Church is the origin of that church is with the Miller period. Sorry that I said they seven times. I don't know if there's any significance to that. But they come from the Millerite movement. They discovered the Sabbath when a Seventh-day Baptist, and that church is even older, Seventh-day Baptist revealed the information to Ellen Harmon, who became Ellen G. White. She married Mr. White, whatever his name was, but she became Ellen G. White, and she became a prophetess to that movement, and they accepted the Sabbath. Many of them did. Now, there's actually a smaller church that probably few of you know about, but there's a smaller church called the Advent Christian Church, which split with the Adventists because they continued to keep Sunday. And they still exist, but they're a lot smaller church. But they're a Sunday-keeping church that came out of the Adventist movement but didn't go along with the keeping of the Seventh-day Sabbath. But anyway, so this prophecy of Daniel 8 became a big issue in the church in the 19th century. What I'm trying to say is that our spiritual ancestors, the Church of God, had to deal with Daniel 8 and what it meant. And they had to deal with Ellen G. White. Ellen G. White was treated as a prophetess and was given such great standing. And our ancestors, spiritually speaking, the Church of God, they couldn't accept that. They couldn't accept that Ellen G. White had to be accepted over the superseding the Bible. They wanted to get back to the Bible. And, you know, let's not worry about Ellen G. White. What does the Bible say? And so when the Adventists organized, one group didn't go along. And they became known as the Church of God Seventh Day. And that's where our roots are as far as church history. Our roots are in the Church of God Seventh Day because they understood that Christ was going to come again. They understood that the Saturday was the Sabbath. But they weren't going to take Ellen G. White and sort of put her on some pedestal and treat her with greater respect than the Scriptures. So a man named Cranmer became the leader of a group which later became known as the Church of God Seventh Day. And a lot of the issue was interpreting Daniel 8. Back some years ago, Herman L. Hay wrote a booklet, and I always chuckle over the title of the booklet. It was called Can You Explain It? And I was thinking, what do you mean, can you explain it? Maybe I'll write another booklet. No. What do you mean, can you explain it? What's it? And it was the Adventist approach to the millennium and why they have the approach they do. And part of it has to do with the way they understand Daniel 8. Let's look at Daniel 8 then, because that's probably what they showed Alexander the Great, and he got so impressed. Wow, this is talking about me. In the third year, I'm in Daniel 8, in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, after the one that appeared to me the first time. I saw in a vision, and it so happened while I was looking that I was in Shushan, the citadel, which is in the province of Elam, and I saw in a vision that I was by the river Ulai, so what is today Iran. And then I lifted up my eyes and saw, and there standing beside the river was a ram, which had two horns, and the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. So a ram has to do with it, with a kingdom, with a military force. And evidently in Arabic, there's a word that means both ram and warrior. And we know there's a football team called the Rams. There's a pickup truck called the Ram. We talk about ramming. You know, we see how rams butt each other with their horns. It's a symbol of power. So there was this ram, and it had two horns, and one was higher than the other. Now, this prophecy is interpreted later on in the book, so you don't have to go wild. You just keep reading it, and the prophecy is interpreted. The two horns are the Medes and the Persians. The Persians came up later chronologically but became dominant, and so that's what it says. The one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. So it's all explained. Everybody understand me until now? We had the Medo-Persian Empire, which is pictured by a ram with two horns, one higher than the other, and that one came up later. I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, and southward. So it didn't go to India, it went west. It went towards Iraq and Turkey and the land of Israel and Egypt, those areas. Didn't conquer the eastern areas. I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, and southward, so that no animal could withstand him, nor was there any that could deliver from his hand. But he did according to his will and became great. And as I was considering, suddenly a male goat came from the west. Oh, we know who that is, right? Across the surface of the whole earth, right, going quickly, without touching the ground. Wow, a flying ram. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. The notable horn is Alexander the Great. So obviously when he read this, he was all excited. Wow. Then he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing beside the river, and ran at him with furious power. And I saw him confronting the ram. He was moved with rage against him, attacked the ram, and broke his two horns. There was no power in the ram to withstand him. Yeah, Alexander really, really made mincemeat out of the Persian Empire, as you know. And he cast him down to the ground and trampled him, and there was no one that could deliver the ram from his hand. So we're talking now, he came to Israel probably around 332 BC, and finally, you know, vanquished Persia around 331. Therefore the male goat grew very great, and when he became strong, the large horn was broken. Oh, I don't know if he read this far, but if he did, he would have known that no one lasts forever. And the large horn was broken, and in place of it, four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven. I've talked about that already. And now we get into the king of the north that you find in Daniel 11, and I won't be reading Daniel 11 today. That's for another time. But you're familiar with the abomination of desolation. You're familiar with Antiochus. He was one of those kings of the north, and he's being talked about here now. And out of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south. Oh, because he was based in Syria, north of the Holy Land, toward the east, which he also did. He invaded further east. And the glorious land. He did conquer the land of Canaan, Palestine, the land of Israel. And it grew up to the host of heaven. So it challenged God's people. It challenged belief in God and belief in the Bible. And it cast down some of the host and some of the stars to the ground and trampled them. He did martyr people who disagreed. He tried to destroy God's religion. He even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host. He replaced the high priest with one of his own thugs, you could say. And by him the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. So he eventually prohibited the sacrifices in the temple from taking place. And then came the pièce de résistance. He substituted a sacrifice to himself. And because he was Antiochus Epiphanes, Epiphanes means the manifestation, the coming to light, you know, the appearance. And so he was the sun god in the flesh. So he was, in effect, the Antichrist of the Old Testament. The sun god's birthday is celebrated, as you know, on December 25th. Since about the 4th century, Christianity has decided to substitute the birthday of the sun god and put instead, you know, Christ's birthday at that time. But about a century and a half before Christ, Antiochus decided that he would celebrate the equivalent of December 25th, that he would celebrate his birthday along with the birthday of the sun god, because he believed he was a manifestation of the sun god. And so he decided to sacrifice on that day, which was the 25th day of the ninth month, the 25th day of Kislev. And he even sacrificed a pig in the Holy of Holies, a complete abomination, and that's covered in Daniel 11. Because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifices, and he cast truth down to the ground and did all this and prospered. So he did temporarily have some success, and so it was a tremendous trial for the Jews because, you know, they were in terrible straits, terribly oppressed, but fortunately things were reversed, you know, and they did win out. A smaller army defeated a mightier army. A guerrilla war for independence defeated this greater army. And it's somewhat like the American Revolution in a way. You know, we didn't figure to beat the British. We Americans didn't figure to beat the British, but we did. And the Jews didn't figure to beat the Antiochus's people, but they did. Now, we had the help of the French, and the Jews had some help from Rome at that time, which was farther to the west and was a rival of Antiochus. So there's a certain analogy with the American Revolution. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that certain one who was speaking, "How long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of desolation, the giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot?" And he said to me, 2,300 erev boker, evenings, mornings. Then the sanctuary shall be cleansed. But what is this 2,300 evenings, mornings? Well, we have every day in the temple there was an evening sacrifice and a morning sacrifice. And so, in effect, he was going to do away with 2,300 sacrifices, evening and morning sacrifices. So since there was an evening sacrifice and a morning sacrifice, we're talking about 1,150 days when there would not be sacrifices. 2,300 sacrifices would not be offered. 1,150 days. And in history, that did come out. What happened was Antiochus sacrificed to the sun god on Kislev 25 of 167 BC, which was December 6th. Then 1,103 days later, on December 14th of 164, the Jews cleansed the temple, rededicated it on that same day. So really Hanukkah is kind of like a rebuttal to the birthday of the sun god. It's kind of God's rebuttal to it. You know, the temple was cleansed on the 25th day of the ninth month, the same day that Antiochus had desecrated it, and that became then the festival of Hanukkah, of dedication, and it went on for 8 days as a kind of mini feast of tabernacles. But that's 1,103 days, so where did the other 47 days come from? Well, evidently, there were 47 days the sacrifices were not permitted to be offered. And then finally, he substituted his own pagan sacrifice. So altogether, you have 1,150 days. That's probably where it comes from. Is everybody all right? You have 1,103 days from the time of the abomination to the end, and very likely then 47 earlier days when there was no sacrifice being offered. That's probably how it comes together. Now, the Jews either read this and followed it, or did it and then looked back on it with great amazement, you know, however you want to understand it. Then it happened, when I, Daniel, had seen the vision and was seeking in the meaning, I'm in verse 15, that suddenly there stood before me one having the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, who called and said, "Gabriel, make this man understand the vision." So now we have an angel coming, and a voice tells the angel, let Daniel know what's going on. So we have Gabriel. So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid and fell on my face. And he said to me, "Understand, son of man, the vision refers to the time of the end." So evidently, Daniel was traumatized, and he fell forward and actually seemingly collapsed and was actually asleep. He was so traumatized by what happened. Now, as he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep with my face to the ground, but he touched me and stood me upright. So he basically got me back to my senses. So this was evidently I guess it was what happened. He fainted, but he fainted forward. Now, I want to tell you something. When you study the Bible, when God comes to you, you fall forward. If you see somebody falling backward, that's demonic. You don't fall backward. You can hurt yourself falling backward. You don't know what's back there. People who fall backward are under demonic influence, not under God's influence. Keep that in mind. It might be good advice to be aware of. Anyway, in verse 18, "Now as he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep with my face to the ground, as I said. But he touched me and stood me upright. And he said, look, I am making known to you what will happen, which will happen in the latter time of the indignation, for at the appointed time the end shall be. The ram which you saw having the two horns, they are the kings of Media and Persia. And you see, the Bible interprets itself if you keep reading. And the male goat is the kingdom of Greece. The large horn that is between his eyes, its eyes, is the first king, Alexander the Great. I'm naming him. The Bible doesn't name him. I'm naming him. As for the broken horn and the four that stood up in its place, four kingdoms shall arise out of that nation, but not with its power. None of those kings was the equal of Alexander the Great. And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their fullness, a king shall arise having fierce features who understands sinister schemes. This is, of course, Antiochus Epiphanes, who was also called by his enemies Antiochus Epimenes, Antiochus the madman, which is probably closer to the truth. His power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. So he had spirit influence, and God allowed this too, for that matter. He shall destroy fearfully and shall prosper and thrive. He shall destroy the mighty and also the holy people. So he's going to have a lot of power, and he was also going to persecute the church. Through his cunning, he shall cause deceit to prosper under his rule, and he shall exalt himself in his heart. He shall destroy many in their prosperity. He shall even rise against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without human means. Now, this is really a double prophecy, because yes, it doesn't refer to Antiochus, and Antiochus did oppose the high priest and even God himself. If you could say the prince of princes could refer even to God himself, because he tried to make himself into a god. But it does seem that this is also talking about an end time when this event will be fulfilled, not in the sense of the 1150 days, that has already happened, but in the sense that a future tyrant is coming who will oppose the prince of princes, meaning Jesus Christ, and who will persecute the church. It seems to be that there will be yet another fulfillment at the end of this prophecy. So it gets somewhat ambiguous at this point. It seems to be talking both about Antiochus and about a future time. Now, it's clarified in Daniel 11 that, in fact, we are talking about also a future time. But we don't have to worry about the 1150 days. That's already happened. What we do have to worry about is a future tyrant. Now, how long is that tyrant going to rule? That's revealed in Daniel 12. As far as the time setting of the end, that's in Daniel 12. But I'm not going to go to that today because that's not my purpose. And the vision of the evenings and mornings, which was told, is true. Therefore, seal up the vision, for it refers to many days in the future. So he's saying, I'm giving this to you now, Daniel, because it is a prophecy, but it's not for your time. And I, Daniel, fainted and was sick for days. So it was very traumatic to hear all of this and to get all this understanding. It was very difficult for him to deal with it. But it says, afterward, I arose and went about the king's business. I was astonished by the vision, but no one understood it. In other words, in his day, it wasn't that clear. And even now, we're going to know more about it when it's all over than we do now. But I think we generally have a handle on it because we've lived so much of it already. A lot of it has happened in history, and we can pretty much surmise from what has happened what will yet happen, where Daniel had not experienced any of it yet, so he didn't understand it. But it was given to him, you know, as a sign of the fact that he was a prophet of God, but yet he wasn't really given to understand it, at least not fully. But what happened was, as I said, the Maccabees, the Hasmoneans, the sons of Mattathias and his five sons, successfully revolted against Antiochus. God aided them. They drove out this Syrian army that had conquered Israel, this Hellenistic Syrian army. They drove them out. They cleansed the temple. They rededicated it roughly 3 years after it had been polluted, and then accepted upon themselves to keep that as a festival from year to year, an eight-day festival, kind of paralleling the Feast of Tabernacles in a way, and also paralleling an earlier festival that had taken place when the temple had been rededicated at an earlier time. At the time of Hezekiah, there were 8 days celebrated then when the temple was rededicated. So the Jews began to keep an eight-day festival of rededication of the temple following their victory over Antiochus, which had been prophesied here in Daniel 8. And it's interesting that it may very well be, if Josephus is correct, that Alexander the Great was even shown this prophecy when he came into the land of Israel. And so that perhaps influenced him to be very kind towards the Jewish people, so they didn't have to worry about him. Unfortunately, they did have to worry about Antiochus, who came much later, and God intervened and spared them and gave them a great victory and another festival to commemorate to this very day. Now, there are some lessons for the church in these events. And that's what I want to finish with. There was an attempt by Antiochus to oppress God's people, to destroy God's religion, to substitute, you know, a pagan culture for the culture of biblically grounded culture, and to substitute false worship for true worship. God's people didn't have the strength to win this battle, but God gave them the help, and they miraculously did win the battle, and they were victorious, and the temple was cleansed. And by the way, it mentions here regarding this king. Let me say something, last thought about Antiochus. In verse 25, notice what it says about him. In the end of verse 25 of Daniel 8, he shall even rise against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without human means. Antiochus was not assassinated that we know of, did not die in battle that we know of. He actually died by disease or by accident. So God, in effect, took care of him. He died without anybody attacking him, killing him. He didn't die fighting in a war or by an assassination, but rather died of disease or accident. So in that sense, God intervened directly, and he died, and he was killed. The final Antiochus, the final tyrant, also will not be defeated by church members as physical church members rising up in some revolution, you know, with our pitchforks in hand, as it were, back in colonial days, as back in the colonial times. No, it's going to be a divine army. Christ will come and supernaturally conquer this final tyrant. And it'll be God intervening, God's intervention in the coming of the Messiah that will beat this final tyrant, not any human army. Follow what I'm saying? So it's a double prophecy. Antiochus was defeated that way, and the final battle will be a supernatural intervention of God, which defeats this final tyrant and brings about the millennium. So as I said, there's a lesson, many lessons, of course, in the Hanukkah account, but one particular lesson is that God's people are on the winning side, and that even when there are pressures to defect, and many Jews did defect at the time of Antiochus, many did compromise and become assimilated into the Hellenistic culture, but those who resisted were victorious. So at a time when it's getting darker, you might say, it's our responsibility to still be the lights. You know, we're still supposed to be the menorah, the Hanukkiah. We're supposed to still shine, let our light shine, even in a dark time, because we ultimately are on the winning side. That is one of the great lessons of this time. And if I want to go to 2 Thessalonians, and I am finishing up, but it's going to take a little while longer, so bear with me. In 2 Thessalonians 2, we have a reference to Hanukkah, in this prophecy, this end time prophecy about this final tyrant that is to come, and he's compared to Antiochus Epiphanes. So let's go to 2 Thessalonians 2. And in 2 Thessalonians 2, talking about this final tyrant, let's go to verse 8. And then the lawless one will be revealed. This is 2 Thessalonians 2:8. Now that hasn't happened yet. That's going to happen at the very, you know, at the time before Christ's return. There will be this Hitlerian kind of figure. You know, Hitler was bad enough, but somebody's coming around who'll be even more powerful than he was. And then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will consume with the breath of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming. So this tyrant will be destroyed supernaturally, as I said. This new Antiochus, this new Antichrist, he will be destroyed by the brightness of Christ's coming. And this is a play on words, because Antiochus was called Antiochus Epiphanes. He thought that he was the bright one. And I'm going to read from the Greek in 2 Thessalonians 2 and verse 8. The Greek says, Epiphaneia tis parousias aftou. Epiphaneia tis parousia aftou, which means the appearing of his coming. So it's the epiphany, the epiphaneia, the brightness of his coming. That, you know, the coming is parousia, and the brightness is epiphaneia. The brightness of his coming will destroy this Antichrist figure, this new Antiochus Epiphanes, the true epiphany, the true manifestation of God, the true S-U-N, who is also the S-O-N of God, you know, the light, the morning star. He will come and destroy this Antiochus figure. So knowing that, you know, and taking heart as we study the story of Hanukkah, whether or not we celebrate it, but as we study the information, as we study the prophecies, we can see that sometimes darkness does tend to dominate, but that ultimately light will dominate, brightness will dominate. And if we stay with it, if we stay with the truth, we're going to be the winners. So that's why if you keep reading 2 Thessalonians, you come to the third chapter and you come to verse 13 in this same chapter. Knowing the story of Hanukkah, we can say this. 2 Thessalonians, Paul writes, "But as for you, brethren, do not grow weary in doing good." So that is one lesson that we can get from Hanukkah. The good did win in the battle of Hanukkah, and the good will ultimately win in this final end time battle. I want to finish now in the book of Galatians. In Galatians, the 6th chapter. So one of the lessons of season of the year is stick with God and you will be the winner with Him. We'll all be winners with Him. Galatians 6 and verse 9. Galatians 6 and verse 9. "And let us not grow weary while doing good, for in due season we shall reap if we do not lose heart." So one of the messages to us, the church, at this season of the year is the Maccabees won and we will win. Well, I thank you for listening, those who did and those who will listen later. Enjoy the rest of the Sabbath. All the best to you and yours.